This episode is brought to you by Fright Rags. Fright Rags is the number one source for horror t-shirts. With specially curated collections created by renowned horror artists, they offer the best art and the best quality anywhere. Brand new today, Fright Rags has released a special limited edition t-shirt for the upcoming Creepshow TV series, debuting later this month on Shudder. Designed by Nathan Thomas Millier, this shirt puts a modern twist on the classic Creepshow comic book cover. But hurry, it's limited to only 300 and will sell out quickly. And then stay tuned on Tuesday, September 10th for their exclusive collection of shirts from Rob Zombie's Three from Hell. Listeners get 10% off their first order with the code WAVES10. That's WAVES10. Again, that's 10% off by using that code at fright-rags.com.
Tonight's episode of Shockwaves is also brought to you by Slasher Crasher, the debut horror comedy novel of David Nora. The night he tried to go home, but he got caught in their drama. It's Halloween, and Nick Roche is a towering figure of evil and stupidity. He escapes from an upstate New York mental hospital he's been committed to for the past 5 years, planning to return to his childhood home where he brutally murdered his babysitter's boyfriend. His plans are halted when he crosses paths with an even more terrifying beast, two high school best friends with some serious beef. Caught in a battle of loyalty that's been brewing for 10 years of their friendship, the two girls, Kathleen Strife and Betsy Coleman, force the feud into a savage showdown, pitting the escaped monster against each other. Who will survive this epic death match? And it's totally wrong to fall in love with a murderous lunatic who just tried to kill your ex-best friend with a machete. It's available on Amazon, at BarnesandNoble.com, and at BlackRoseWriting.com. For more info, you can find David Nora on Twitter and Instagram at David Nora Jr. Again, the novel is called Slasher Crasher.
Tonight's show is also brought to you by Wellgo USA and their amazing new releases. First up is Freaks. They Look Just Like Us. Bruce Dern, Emile Hirsch, and Amanda Crew star in the genre-bending psychological sci-fi thriller Freaks. In theaters this Friday 13th, don't miss the film that critics are calling visually stunning, gripping, and a whole different level. Also, they have the Phantasm Sphere Collection. The Sphere is back and scarier than ever. One of the world's most popular franchises is the history of horror, the Phantasm film series has terrified fans for generations. Now get the exclusive Phantasm Sphere Collection loaded with never-before-seen bonus features and an actual Phantasm Sphere replica. Look for it at Halloween. Boy! Hello and welcome back to episode 158 of Shockwave. I almost forgot the name of the show.
You've been gone for
like a month. Shockwaves?
Yeah. It's been a while. I was like, wait, what show am I?
I think for you, this must have been about the longest you've been away.
Yes, yeah, 3 weeks so. That we missed you.
Yes, it was very nice. Yeah. I enjoyed the chaotic nature of the Elric Kane and Rebecca McKendry hour.
It was
yes.
Nuts.
Your new show.
And Deep Cuts. Deep Cuts. So we actually were pitching two shows at once.
You had two less hosts and still managed to deliver the longest episode.
Was it
had.
Right? Yeah. I know.
Well, it's, over 2 hours.
Oh, I think
so
it was the writers.
Fucking long. No, it was because we were doing the list, and yeah, it was so long.
Just out of control.
They were great guys, though. Those two were really cool.
They were. I was bummed I missed them. Yeah. Yeah. I really was. But hey, we're back. Holy smokes.
So how was France?
France is fantastic. I was going to get into that.
Okay, we can talk about it after.
After? Whatever.
I saw you eat that bloody food, and it really grossed me out. What's it called?
Bloody food?
The food that was like...
It was the raw...
Steak tartare.
That's the one.
That grossed me out. Like,
why?
I burn steak, and so just seeing you eat that raw steak, because I remembered I was in Paris one time when I was 20, and I went to a McDonald's and got a cheeseburger, and I bit into it, and it was fucking raw inside, and it changed my life.
Well, okay, so...
So gross.
First of all, they the first restaurant I went to, I had a steak, and I ordered it well done, mm-hmm. and they like laughed at me.
Yeah, no, I hear they kick people out for that.
The waiter came back 3 times to say, are you sure?
Are you serious?
I'm like... Yes, that's the way I like it. I'm like, American. But anyway, so there was that. Steak tartare. The only reason I know steak tartare is because of the movie Waxwork.
Oh, yeah. Nice.
Like, because he's like, oh, yes, steak tartare.
Yeah. Steak tartare.
Which is just raw
meat.
Is it good though?
Yeah.
It's actually delicious.
Okay. Wow.
That's the thing. It's like, it's not like they give you raw meat, like the way you buy it. It's like chopped up and prepared and it's mixed with seasoning.
So it's like a poke bowl or poke bowl or however you say it, where it's like raw fish.
That's gross too.
Kind of chopped up. See, I'll do that. But if I'm eating a burger, I want that thing burnt. Like,
me too. No, but they would laugh at you about that.
Yeah. I love that though.
But that, I guess we are talking about Paris now. We crossed paths with filmmaker Glenn McQuaid, happened to be in town while I was there.
Was that? I was wondering, is that planned or are you just walking through a friend's marketplace and there's Glenn McQuaid?
I think he mentioned on Instagram, he's like, hey, you know, me and his partner Lee and their mothers were in Paris. They were like on a vacation. And so I was like, oh, let's grab lunch tomorrow.
I love that they vacation with their mothers.
I know, it was so
sweet. I want stories there.
Well, I didn't meet the mothers. We did. They were on a break and came and met us, and we had one of the typical 3-hour meals, because there, every meal is like 3 hours, thankfully. They take their time. They don't give you all these like ridiculous portions.
Wait,
or rush
is this
you.
Like it takes 3 hours for them to like bring the food out to you, or do you just sit there a long time?
No, I mean, the big difference for our very fascinated listeners listening to a horror show that want to know about cuisine in France. It's funny because when Alyssa comes here, she's surprised by American portions.
Of course.
Which are these ginormous, what they serve. Like, that's
she
for one person.
She took pictures of my plate. I remember
she was
that.
Like, wow, look at all that food. And also the fact that people come over and ask you like 10 times in 15 minutes if you're okay.
Yeah.
She's like, that's rude. Like, well, all right. So they do a lot of food because they're competing with 8 million other restaurants.
Right.
And really, it's all about bodies. They want you to finish, get out, and serve the next people. And, you know, just it's all about money. Over there, it's like the portions are normal. It's just chill. Like, you sit down, the first thing, order of business is like a beer. And then a few minutes later, like, all right, you want an appetizer? And then you get like a salad. And then you get
food's a social thing.
It is.
In Europe in general. Yeah.
I mean, Glenn and I had snails. That was exciting.
I actually do like that. I've tried that.
Snails.
Yeah. And I thought they were really good.
Yeah. I was surprised.
Yeah, escargot.
There's
well, if you think of snails like is the thing that you saw in your yard and you're like, I'm not going to eat that freaking thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But no, it's
slugs.
Totally different.
Yeah. There was a place near me when I lived in New York that used to serve snails. And they were like mussels. They came in like gutter, like a garlic and butter sauce,
They taste like mushrooms, pretty much. I mean, there's no taste to them. The taste is that they like whatever they do, they boil it in like garlic and butter, and so that's what you're tasting. Sometimes
just make sure don't eat leeches; they're different than.
No,
some
I know. I'm well aware.
Don't make that mistake. I did that for all of you.
And then I had
foie gras.
Have you heard of foie gras?
That's like stuffed
foie gras. Yeah,
that's the evil stuff. They like. Tortured a baby goose to make that, right?
Listen, let us not talk about how it's made. But only the French would come up with it.
Oh, that is the baby.
Force feed a baby goose.
Is it a goose?
Yeah.
It's duck or a goose. It's really horrific how it's made.
Yeah.
But kind of delicious. And so I remember I texted a friend saying, I just had foie gras. It's cruel, but delicious.
Evilly delicious.
And they wrote, it was Natasha, and she wrote me back and she said, that's the French motto, cruel, but delicious. So I tried a lot of really odd, interesting things.
But that's good. I'm glad that you stretch yourself when you travel.
I will. And we will delve into going into stores and some of the photos and movies are promoted there, which
you sent us some pretty cool photos. So we'll get to that.
I got some awesome
but
stuff.
We have two surprise guests coming in at the very beginning of our show from the Mystic Museum, aka Bearded Lady Vintage. Do you still go by both names?
Yes, it's two separate stores.
Two separate stores,
in one
but
awesome location.
Yes, in one awesome spot. They've done a lot of shows. That was the voice of Eric Wessel and Jose Canas. I'm going to say your name wrong again.
Yeah.
Canas, sorry. Welcome. And you guys are here because by the time this airs, this is airing on Friday. So tomorrow, Saturday, September
7th,
thank you. You guys are doing an Evil Dead exhibit at the Mystic Museum.
Yes, it's much more than an exhibit this time around.
Much more. Okay.
This is like a full like prop museum, right?
Yes, it's going to be featuring props, photo ops, you know, immersive experience. It's going to be like an art show, everything. Mm. So we're definitely stepping up a couple notches for this show.
Very cool. And so just to give context, because I know a lot of our listeners know, Eric collaborated with Ryan on Slashback Video.
Yes.
We did an episode from Slashback Video at one point.
Yeah.
And you'd done other stuff like there is a really cool show for The Shining, for example, mm-hmm. where you can get behind the bar and take a photo as if you're Jack or whatever. So how did this show come together and you know, how is it going to be different from some of those other things you did?
Well, I'll let Jose start that one.
Okay. Yeah, cool. So I work over at Ghost House Pictures, Sam Raimi's production company.
Yes.
And I had recently started working there. I want to say I was about like 8 months in or so. And his producing partner, Rob Tappert, was in town, asked me to come meet him at his old storage unit. And he was like, help me clean all this stuff out. And then in famous Rob fashion, he was like, I'm going to go keep doing this. So I kept doing it. And slowly but surely, I started noticing like just these things that looked like they belonged in The Evil Dead. And I was like, this looks familiar. What's this chainsaw doing here? And I started realizing these were actual props from the movies. I was carrying the chainsaw. I was carrying the boomstick. There was a box that I flipped over, and on the side it just said in Sharpie, Necronomicons. Like, multiple Necronomicons. And I was like, oh my God. And it was literally Christmas for me. Christmas in August or whatever, whenever I found it.
Wow.
And it was such a great experience. And I remember in that moment, I was by myself. I didn't have anyone to share it with. It just felt so wrong because I love these movies. I grew up on The Evil Dead. And I remember that's one of the first horror movies that I saw where I was like, what is this that I'm watching? I love horror movies, I think. And but I know that there's other people out there. So I went back to Rob and Sam and then we, you know, looped Bruce into the conversation. And we started talking about doing an Evil Dead Museum and showing these props to everyone else. And that's when I reached out to Eric and Kiko over at the museum, Mystic Museum. And
had you already been
regular? Yeah, I think my first show was actually Slashback, and I saw what they did with Slashback, and I saw that it was handled with such care and love, and I was like, these are the right people to do this with. So I approached them and I was like, hey, you guys don't know me. I have all these Evil Dead props. And
Eric was probably like, cool.
Best friends for life.
Yeah. I don't even know if, did you believe me at first or like?
No. The thing is, we get a lot of that. So not really, but really.
Fair enough.
So, you know, what I didn't like is I didn't get your contact information right away.
Oh, yeah.
Should have got his contact information.
I'm so awkward. So I was so nervous. And I was like, I don't know these people. I'm such big fans. Hi, I have all these Evil Dead props. And then I just left. I didn't give him my name's Jose. Mm-hmm. But I didn't give him my phone number, my email address and stuff. And then we got really busy at the office and stuff. So I was gone for like a month, maybe even 2 months and stuff. And then I showed back up at the Mystic Museum and I was like, hey, you guys still want to do that thing? And they were like, yeah, where have you been? But we're really excited. And now here we are, 3 days away from opening, right?
One day.
Tomorrow.
And this will be, so Saturday is the, what we call kind of like the big, premiere, opening
reception.
Opening reception, there you go. And this is going to run all the way through December?
December 7th, yeah.
So what else so people show up, what's the admission for this thing?
It's $12 at the door. Mm-hmm. And basically the difference between the museum just coming during regular business hours is this. We have all sorts of amenities that come with the opening night. You know, it's just like a really awesome party. Hang out, mingle with people. There's going to be music. There's going to be free food, free drinks, all of the above. First dibs at the art that's going to be for sale.
Yeah.
It's just going to be a basically a very awesome party with it. Horror props everywhere.
Yeah, and the coolest thing about it is you never really know who's going to be there on opening night. Yes. I mean, I've been to a few of these opening nights. I'm always surprised, and I'm like, whoa, I know that person. Mm-hmm. But I will say that
it's Shockwaves. You were excited that we were there. Yeah, I know it.
Yeah, it's you guys. Yeah. Some of these people have actually been on Shockwaves and stuff, so I've listened to them, and I'm like, oh, I'm so excited to meet these people. So
that's fun. And I think, I'm just curious what obviously you're a big fan, both of you are big fans, but like, what was your first experience with Evil Dead? Was it the original movie? Was it one of the sequels?
It was the first movie. So I feel like the first movie in the Evil Dead series that you watch is the one that's your favorite. I don't know. So for me, it was the Evil Dead. The first time I watched Evil Dead 2, I was kind of confused.
Most of us were.
But yeah, I was way too young to watch it. I had it, rented it from Blockbuster, went to my house. I remember my parents weren't there because I don't think I was allowed to watch it and stuff. So I waited for them to leave. And then I like pulled it out from under my bed, stuffed it in the DVD player and I was just watching it.
DVD
was,
player? Oh. Oh, I'm talking VHS.
Well, right. Oh, yeah. No, he's actually, 16, so what are you going to do? Stop hating on him.
Yeah. Actually, the first time I saw it was on TV.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah, I was like USA Up All Night or something like that. So it was edited.
Heavily like edited, crit. I'm sure.
I remember seeing Army of Darkness in the theater.
I saw Army of Darkness in the theater, and then I saw Evil Dead 2 was rented. And that I was like, didn't I already see this movie, but different? Am I in a dream right now? And I was really confused because I was young.
Yeah. That's the cool thing about the first one is it's one of those horror films that I can honestly say when I started, I probably was like 12 or something, I'd never seen a movie like it ever. Yeah. And I'd seen a lot of horror films, but I knew it was different. And I felt instantly. But part one will always be my favorite for just why you said, even though I know two is like this more polished, it's a funnier film, but there's something about one, the homemade feel
of it.
It's
so raw.
Yeah. I didn't see one till like a decade later. Like I remember seeing two in like middle school on VHS. And then being in the theater for Army of Darkness, and I don't think I saw the first one until I was probably like out of college by the time I watched
it. I actually had no idea Army of Darkness was part of the series at all. And I remember just it started, I was like, oh my god, I'm super excited for this now.
Universal didn't know it was part of the series.
I saw a triple. It's one of the weirdest things ever because New Zealand didn't usually get old movies and stuff. It was, I swear to god, it was Weekend at Bernie's 2, Army of Darkness, and Hellraiser 3.
That makes so much sense.
And I went to it going, well, how are these movies even playing together? But it
we
was
should recreate that.
Life altering.
I know. I kind of want to make the universe in which they all exist. Like, Pinhead has reanimated Bernie's body. And
that could work.
I'm going to make
it happen. Bernie is a Deadeye. I love it.
You guys are big. Make it happen.
Yeah.
I remember watching Evil Dead for the first time. The reason I wanted to watch it so bad was, I know you guys call me 16 and stuff, but there was Blockbuster.
I don't know how old
you're a very young looking fellow. That's all. Okay?
That's fair.
You're just a fetus.
There was Blockbuster back when I was growing up, and I went with all my friends at one point, and we were walking through the horror aisle, and they pointed at the Evil Dead cover. It's the first time I had ever seen the cover. I didn't know anything about it at the time, and they go, "The Evil Dead. That looks like something Jose would like," but they were saying it in such a like mocking tone, like they were making fun of it. And I was like, this makes me want to watch the movie. And then I think I came back like 2 days later. I watched it and I went back to all my friends and I was like, joke's on you, you fuckers. Like, this is a good movie. All right. Let me show you guys. And I showed them all. But
it was probably the remake, right?
Oh, I do love the remake.
Oh, I do too. Don't get me wrong. I love Fetty's film. Yeah. I think it's one of the better remakes.
Love the remake. But
you know what? I'm going to talk about it right now since they're here and it's relevant. Yeah. So while I was in Paris, one of the many movies I watched, Alyssa and I did a double feature of the original Evil Dead with the extended cut of the remake, which I've never had the opportunity to watch. So,
I haven't seen it either.
You were different because you, Elric, I'm pointing to Elric. Elric avoided all the trailers.
Yeah, for that
one. So when we went to see it, you were like blown away and you loved it. I liked it, but I was mildly disappointed because so much from the trailers was not in the final movie.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what happened to that chainsaw scene and this and that, blah, blah, blah. And then, of course, I appreciated it when I saw it again because you know, now that's out of context. You're like, oh, okay, this is a cool movie.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they put out the extended initially, I think, digitally, and now it's just part of a Blu-ray. Like, you can get it. It comes with both versions.
What's the deal with, I know, so there's a 4K, you know, one of the places we're going to be in Knoxville, there's a, and at Beyond Fest, they're going to be this new 4K, but everyone keeps talking about with new music.
Joe, what's the name of the composer again?
Joe LaDuca,
I'm sorry. So Joe LaDuca did most of the music for 1 and 2 and 3, minus the theme, which Danny Elfman did. And he's reprised and done the show.
Mm-hmm.
He did a rescore of it. It's now been a couple of years that Mondo has put out as a separate release. And, you know, it's the same thing as like when Fabio Frizzi redid The Beyond. And since, you know, it's Bob Murawski, Grindhouse releasing, I imagine he has a version of Evil Dead without the soundtrack. Because when we saw The Beyond, that was the cool thing, was that they were showing the movie with the audio, but they removed the soundtrack, and Fabio performed a new score live.
Yeah.
And it was like, oh, because normally like it's kind of like loud and noisy because they're trying to play over the existing music. So I assume that that's what it's going to be.
Okay.
Is he's just going to do a new score to it while we watch it. Which
I think I read something though about like that they couldn't put all the music on back then because of the cheapness of the production. There was some problem with the prints and stuff.
Yeah. You guys are going to laugh. I'm not really sure when it comes to that. But but I will say that the new soundtrack, which is available via Mondo, it's just incredible. Like I have a record player in my office and I just play it constantly. Like, I think it's worn out at this point. And,
yeah, it's really cool. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting when composers can go back with some sort of, you know, hindsight and be like, oh, I would do it this way now.
Yeah.
And so, I don't know. It'll be interesting to see.
Sorry.
No, I was going to – so the extended version.
Yeah.
So I actually kind of like it better. Okay. It's it changes the pacing because everything feels just a little bit longer. Mm. Like some of the scenes play out a little bit longer. But the things I noticed that were different about it were a lot more character stuff, like why they don't believe her when, you know, everything starts. Because they cut out this whole thing that this is like the second or third attempt at detoxing the main girl. And they're like, she did this last time where she was seeing stuff and blah, blah, blah. So it just adds a little bit more context to why they keep her at this cabin and why they stay and why it takes so long for them to believe that anything's actually happening. The violent stuff is a little even more gorier than I remember.
Oh, hell yeah.
And my favorite stuff, which it – I don't – I mean, I guess I know why they cut it all out, but especially when you watch it back to back with the original – is so many references and callbacks to the series. Mm-hmm. So like the one in the trailer that they cut out is her singing the song.
We're going to get you. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which is not in the movie. And then my other favorite one is there's one, the guy with the glasses.
Oh yeah.
It's the actor's name.
From Thumbsucker and all that.
Yeah. And he was in Spring as well.
Yeah.
But anyway, there's,
oh yeah,
I love him.
There's a part where they're having a conversation about killing one of the friends and he's like, everything's fine. It's fine. And he's like, we just cut up our friend with a chainsaw. Does that sound fine?
Oh, nice.
So I'm like, oh, so it's like stuff like that where it's like if you're a fan of the franchise, like they gave you all those little cool beats, which aren't in the final version. But the pacing is a lot slower. Uh-huh. It feels a lot longer because it's there. But I don't know. I actually kind of loved it.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's like, oh, that's a very cool. Oh, and also what happens at the ending makes more sense.
The raining blood?
Yeah, because
and her just circling the car endlessly.
Yeah, because in the theatrical, so you know, minor spoilers if you haven't seen the remake at this point. Yeah. But like, here's who suffers the most from it: the brother character, the one from Dead Girl.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he gets the shit kicked out of him.
Well, in the extended, he is Ash.
Oh, okay.
Like he is a big part of it. All the way to the end, and then that's kind of like they make the shift to his sister. Mm-hmm. But there's literally three separate rituals that have to happen for it to rain blood, and they cut two of them out.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So, oh, wow.
So they go through the book. There's like three very specific things that have to happen.
Mm.
And so I was like, oh, well, that makes more sense now.
I kind of want to see this.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
But
the good
really
thing
cool.
about the shorter one, without having seen longer one, is the thing I loved about it is how it moves.
Yeah,
it moves like lightning, and you don't think you just get battered around. I love that.
You guys remember how pregnant I was seeing that?
Because
I was with you. I don't know if Rob was coming. I was 2 weeks past my due date with Marnie, and I was walking in. The publicist stopped me, and she goes, "I hope to God you go into labor during this
because we're gonna."
She was like, "We're gonna put it on the poster that it induced a woman into labor." I did not. I went 2 days later, but it was the last movie I saw.
Would have been cool.
It would have been cool.
Great. That's a story.
Yeah. But yeah, I recommend it. And it's readily available now on Blu-ray. And it's what's cool is it comes with both discs. So
nice.
Theatrical and extended. So anyway, anything from the remake in the show or is this specifically OG?
Yeah. So a lot of OG props, but we have a couple nods to the remake.
Art.
The remake and stuff.
So the artists who are part of the show, they just, you know, we give them open rein to do whatever they want, and you know, we could feature anything as long as it's original art. So everyone kind of did everything from everything. You're gonna see a wide variety of the whole franchise. Yeah.
But we also do have the Book of the Dead from the remake as well. So
cool.
Yeah,
we got some personal collections in there too. So it's gonna be cool.
Wow, excellent. All right, well, thanks for dropping by and telling us about
it. So much.
I don't know if I should announce now, but Jose has guaranteed us Sam Raimi on the show. Guaranteed us. He looked me in the eye before the show started and said, "I will deliver you, Sam Raimi."
It only took us 6 years, but I really got to say it was worth it. So.
I do have to before we go is thank the sponsors who sponsored this event, which is, you know, we definitely helps us give us a bigger, better event, and hopefully everyone appreciates it when they come out and to the event. So I have to thank Shudder, who sponsored it, Creepy Co, Fangoria, Fright Rags, The Haunt Store / Video, and Trick or Treat Studios. They definitely helped out, and we couldn't do it without them. We would sure try, though.
Well, I mean, this is cool because it's not like it's just some weekend. This is like our listeners who live everywhere literally have months.
Check it out.
If they can come out to LA, this is going to put it on your radar.
There's going to be some limited edition merch too, which is going to be awesome. Cool. Some that's available in store only, some that it's all just available through us. But some will be online, but especially the art is amazing. So I checked that out, and the props.
Oh yeah.
Holding some stuff in my hands and I'm just like, can't believe
we've got some awesome
this.
Props. Yeah. Yeah.
Did Robert Tappert bring any Kiwi stuff over with him from the New Zealand shoot, the TV show?
Unfortunately not. No. So we have one. Okay. One prop from you're talking about Ash vs. Evil Dead or so we have one from that. But yep.
Mm-hmm. All right. So you would never know if you're gonna ask these are the questions.
Yeah, but go see it for yourself. Opening tomorrow, September 7th, 8 PM to 12 AM. Yeah.
Excellent.
Right on.
There we go.
Cool. Cool. Thanks guys.
Thank you guys.
Thank you guys.
What do you have to say, Rob G?
Got a lot to say.
Let's go back to France, baby. well, it ties in because one of my favorite things there is the way that American movies are marketed. Uh-huh. And so the bus ads everywhere were for this wonderful new movie called Wedding Nightmare.
Mm. Which I saw.
I've seen as well, which is called Ready or Not here.
I like the title, Wedding Nightmare.
Who would have thought?
I know. And it's pretty funny. So then I went into one of their...
Do you think that's because they don't have that game? Like Radio Nuts, probably not even a game there.
Yeah, I mean, that's the main thing is a lot of those phrases don't make sense. Mm-hmm. So it's like ready or not, like the literal translation of it just doesn't mean anything.
But when they put it on posters, it looks like they actually put the English words instead of whatever Wedding Nightmare translates to in French. Yeah. They put Wedding Nightmare.
What's that about?
I don't know.
Maybe it's just for you.
I don't work in marketing over there. Yeah,
probably a lot of British people.
Well, that scary stories is just scary stories. And we went to a store, and the entire Purge franchise is called American Nightmare.
That makes sense.
Yeah, so the fourth one was called American Nightmare: The Origin. And I was like, and basically, like Alyssa was explaining to me, it's like basically anything that comes from America is a nightmare. So it's like Wedding Nightmare, American Nightmare, etc. And then we delved into comedies, and she's like, I think Very Bad Things, that movie from like 99 or whatever it was like a big hit or something. Every comedy there starts with Very Bad. Oh, so the Hangover franchise is called Very Bad Weekend or something like that.
Very Bad Weekend at Bernie's.
Yes. The other guys, Will Ferrell, Mark Wahlberg movie is called Very Bad Cops. Like you can do a deep dive. I think there's a thread in the Shockwaves group with all these alternate titles. But I thought it was fun. I sent you guys some photos.
Cover of their cover for Ms. 45, which is fucking rad. Amazing. It's great. It's like literally like a hand holding a bag of body parts.
Yes. It's pretty
great.
Wild. I picked up the Dentist 1 and 2 because when else are those going to be on Blu-ray? I was like, oh, it's great. It's available here.
Oh, I didn't even know they weren't.
Yeah. Right. No, they haven't come out here yet. Of course, now that I bought it for a ridiculous amount, I'm sure Scream Factory will announce it tomorrow or something. But
so you're trip is Escargot and the Dentist.
The Dentist on Blu-ray. Nice. It was quite eventful.
That is a winner.
It was pretty great. And I watched a lot of movies. So you guys talked about scary movies, scary stories.
I did not enjoy it.
I didn't like it either, and I know you mentioned that I didn't like it, and you're right. I am in the minority on Twitter.
I am too.
Here's my problem, because I first of all, it should have been an anthology.
Boom.
Plain and simple. Yes. That's the first thing. I think they did an okay job. It's an interesting narrative. I don't know why they picked the 60s. Yeah. I don't know why they went overboard with the Nixon thing, which is like,
I mean, that's
that was the most confusing because you've read the books, right?
I have them. And I mean, my memory is the books are only like a page or two long each story.
They're just
like
super quickie, short stories.
Almost like poems.
Yeah.
You know?
And some of them are poems.
Andre Overdahl.
Yeah, the guy who did Autopsy.
No, I was trying to find
who said he didn't grow up with the books at all. So he just thought they looked cool.
No, I was just trying to figure out like why. I mean, the 60s, I know everyone out there knows that they're guessing it's the parable of like young men going to their death for Vietnam. That part I get, but I don't – that's like one little part of it.
Obvious enough.
No, it was so overwhelming.
But that also seems like a big choice to make just for that one.
Yeah.
I was looking for some type of deeper parallel between the characters – and that, like young men going to their death and just, you know, a bunch of stories that kill you. I did not make a connection to Nixon.
Well, I guess the word disappear, like because people are disappearing in these stories, just like people are never coming back. But I agree with you. Like it could have been Reagan in the '80s and could have been fun. Like who knows?
It could have been anything. Yeah. I was a little disappointed in the execution of it, and it's like I don't know what the point was of making all the actual characters from the stories look exactly like them, but have no context. It's like, so, oh, that's cool that they showed up, but like, and then it's like the characters just kept making really stupid decisions as the movie went further along. Mm-hmm. And I know, like, my tweet was all about CG, which is CG will always take me out. And I get it. I got 1,000 of you replying to me, showing me practical effects on set. Listen, I love early Del Toro. I'm going to say some controversial shit now. Del Toro's too reliant on CG. Mm-hmm. It, like, it's a marriage of both, but he overdoes it. And for me,
it's what killed me on Crimson Peak.
Crimson Peak, yeah. I didn't know Doug Jones was in a costume in that movie.
I didn't either.
I've seen photos after the fact, but in the movie, that's a fail. When you put so much CG smoke around a practical effect, it looks like CG. And so with this, to me, it's like every time one of these like scary story characters was going to appear, the wall behind them had this CGI black stuff, smoke.
Yeah. That's what I figured
and
you
I'm
were
out.
Meaning.
Yeah, like the second I see CG black smoke on a wall, it's like, I don't care what you show me, I'm not scared at all.
Yeah.
And so I didn't find it particularly scary either. So I just thought it was a missed opportunity of a movie. They could have – they were going the Goosebumps route, which is ironic because Goosebumps is totally a CG movie. Mm. But it's very forgiving in 3D and it's also a lot more fun and the story works. But I was just so – like that's the thing. I was like so disappointed and now I'm just always cautious of any Del Toro thing even though everyone loves him unapologetically. It's like sorry, Guillermo, if you're listening.
I think that's what did it for me was it went the Goosebumps route plot-wise and some of the scares definitely went the Goosebumps route. But then we have the Vietnam War. So it's like Goosebumps set during the Vietnam War. And it did not feel like it meshed to me. It was like a Goosebumps-ish story, but it had all these weird adult tones to it. And then the backstory when we're getting into elements of like there was child abuse and, you know, and this guy's being shipped off to his death. And it was kind of, it just did not feel as crisp as I wanted it
all right,
to.
And I was having this conversation with somebody the other day. So listeners, mild spoiler regarding the ending. I'm telling you now so you could skip 5 minutes ahead if you want to. Once again, mild spoiler to the end. But it's kind of like the resolution wasn't very satisfactory. It was basically the lead girl being like, listen, ghost, I know you were wrong, but bad ghost.
Yes,
stop it.
That was it exactly.
Stop being bad. This is on you.
I mean, I think that is actually how you dispel ghosts.
Elric and I saw it together, and as we were leaving the theater, I was like, and the secret to all of it was just telling the ghost they were being an asshole.
Yeah, I get it. You were wrong, but you're wrong now.
You're wrong now.
Yeah. Stop it. Stop it. I was just like, okay, I guess. Anyway, I don't know.
It had some fun moments.
I was pretty neutral, but I really did like the one in the cornfield, and I liked
that's
cornfield.
Great, yeah.
But that's one of the actual stories, like Harold and the idea of him stealing skin, like that.
It was also just good directing, like you know.
Yeah,
he's
up
really
to
good
there
director,
was
yeah.
cool,
and the, and the one with the where the guy eats the toe, I thought that was well,
that's also
story,
one
yeah.
of the original
but,
stories.
But as it went, it became less focused. It like it's just like the second half, it just seems to lose.
Well, I mean, the spider scene, it's like what a great setup. Up and then it's like totally ruined by CG spiders. Yeah. And I'm like, ugh. I don't know. Yeah. I'm an old man complaining about CG. Speaking of CG, anyone see 47 meters down on Cage?
Yo,
didn't we
Rebecca?
Talk about
yeah,
that?
Yeah, we talked about it.
Did
last
you talk about
week.
It? Yeah. I know you talked about scary stories. I missed it. I went to see that because Ready or Not was sold out the first time I went to go see it, which is very surprising.
Great.
47 meters down is not nearly as good as the first one.
I had fun with it, though.
Let's talk about the first 23 minutes.
It was fun and really stupid.
I think the first 23 are dramatically the weakest drama of the year.
I think I definitely.
Oh, yes.
Said this on the show
I
last
almost
week.
Almost forgot already.
But there was a moment where I leaned over and said, if these girls do not stop driving soon, I'm leaving.
it really did feel like old men writing, and not that Johannes is that old, but like it did feel like these guys writing these characters who are like, have you ever met a girl?
That's such a free spirit.
It's young
Let's
girls.
Dance and sing.
I mean, yeah, it gets fun as it goes. I guess it's been a couple weeks now. Well, I guess we're going to do it again. Quick spoiler. Where it goes towards the end, not the very end, but where there's all the chum.
That was brilliant.
No, but I turned to her after and I said, I would start the movie there. Characters come and it's called Chum and they're stuck in a shitload of chum as sharks are coming. That would be a good
movie. That's your ridiculous finale.
Cheering. Yeah, that's where I would start.
It was great.
So the setup is kind of whatever. It's like these girls, they're sisters or like stepsisters and don't exactly get along. And then they go to this remote, I don't even know what it is.
It's like a lagoon, but connected to the ocean.
It opens up a Mayan temple.
Yeah. And they're only there because their dad, who discovered it, and his two coworkers are on the other side of the island or whatever.
Yeah.
But then they go down there, they get stuck, and then they run into the dad and all the coworkers. I remember the friend I was with turned to me at one point, like, how many freaking people are down here?
Yeah.
Literally, every few minutes, a new person would show up underwater. You're like, wait, the dad's down there too?
It's and they have radios, and I'm going, how are we listening to
I'm pretty sure you can't listen to music underwater.
No.
Also, the audio is so clean, like the way they talk to each other. It's just
I'm pretty sure that's not how it works.
They have full comtext set up down there.
And I just lost track of once the whirlpool thing happened, I was like, I don't even know what the hell's happening right now. Like, I don't know how they're trying to get out, what their plan is.
No, as soon as the giant shark showed up, all I could think is, we saw one very small fish. What are they eating that have kept them down there for so long? And then I was like, you know what? Fuck it. Go cave sharks.
Blind cave sharks.
And then I was cheering for the blind cave sharks the whole time.
You know what else? It seems like for shark movies these days, they are shark attacks are the new Final Destination shock kill. Mm. Meaning like they could just be in the middle of any sort of scene and out of nowhere a shark
would least expect it. You mean sharks.
And you're like
Sam
what?
Jackson.
Where the hell did that thing come from? It was like a freaking bus from Final Destination.
Right now. Shark. Shark. You didn't expect that.
I couldn't get over the that's what happened to Turk. That's why he got sharked. That's why he's not here. Sharked. No, I couldn't get over the opening scene where they're at the high school and it says Modine High School. And I was like, ugh, because Matthew Modine's in the last movie. And I was like, okay. As soon as I saw that, I was like, all right, it's going to be that way.
All right.
So sorry.
All right. So that's 47 Meters Down the Pitch.
I had fun.
How about the honeymoon nightmare?
Wedding nightmare?
Ready or not? I loved.
You loved it?
Yes. Okay. I had a blast with it. Honestly, it was I won't say my favorite film of the year, but it's been in the top so far. Like the amount of just smiles. I don't think Elric felt the same way.
Oh, really? I had a blast with it. But I will preface by saying that it was overhyped for me, only because it came out, it became the surprise hit and everyone's like, oh, you have to go see Ready or Not like right away. And I'm like, oh, okay, cool. And I went to see it. I liked it a lot. I think the premise is a girl gets married into this family and she has to play this game, which basically is them trying to hunt her to kill her.
And they're millionaires based on the fact that they're like gaming.
They have a gaming empire.
I love all that. That's actually
a lot of fun.
I really like the movie. I just it goes back to my trailer issue, which is the first hour of this movie was everything that was in the trailer is fucking great. Like I loved that. This isn't a
that was the other thing. The trailer did way too much.
And it made me want to see the movie, and it nails the tone. It's a great trailer, but I was sitting in the first hour kind of half enjoying it, half going, yep, okay, I see that.
Yeah.
And then Samara Weaving is like it's one of the best
incredible performances
of the year.
Yeah, you all need to see the Picnic at Hanging Rock miniseries on Amazon because she's the lead and she's fucking brilliant
in
it.
Yeah.
I only told you guys about that one 2 years ago, so it's a little early for you to catch up on that, Becca Rec. Wait another year and then circle back to it.
I've seen the movie, so it's hard for me to ever go see a show after I've seen a movie. We'll see it. But she's also good in The Babysitter, which isn't a great movie, but she's great in it.
Oh, and I mean, Jill Lynch's movie, Mayhem.
Yeah, oh, Mayhem.
Great.
Well,
yeah,
that's right. She is really good. But my issue is I think it's just a tonal thing. Like I was just a little, the way that they're so broad comic characters from the frame one, except her, she's really grounded. That's what's interesting about it. I think if they had been a little more grounded and it had been like maybe 15 minutes or so before I knew, their intentions are clear. And that is cool. Like I know a lot of people probably that's why they like it. I think I'd still get to Dick about it. He's like, it's the perfect spec script. It's just like, boom, you're in. And he's right. It's really hard to talk about the issues and it's still too new, but most of it comes towards the end, even though there's a really fun ending. What I don't like is it's not a challenge to the lead character kind of thing. Mm. And so for me, there's things I would have liked to have seen gone differently.
Oh, like things just happen and then it was...
I think a little bit, but it's also really fun. I had fun with the end.
I agree with you on all of that. I was a little, but that's what I meant by it was a little too hype for me. It's like not only the talk, but I'm watching it knowing what's coming because of the trailer. Mm-hmm. And then they very masterfully delivered what I consider a very satisfying conclusion, where I was like,
it was wonderful.
No, it's just great.
It is,
and, well, it's also where, and where you were not talking about, like, and it's an ending that makes a lot of sense when you know who made it. It's Radio Silence.
Yeah, I was so surprised by that.
So the last segment of VHS,
which is
like
terrifying,
in-camera.
Which I showed to Elric's students last week.
No, and I mean, in-camera effects, it's exactly the opposite of what you're talking about with CG doing, and I love that about their work. And there's quite a few moments like, no, I really like this movie. I just didn't, something just stopped me from loving it, and that's fine because, like, I loved the trailer. I was already in, you know, so I think it's a tone thing. I think if they had been treated a little more real, some of the characters, oh, sorry, the guy she was marrying was such a dick. I really liked what's his name?
Adam Brody.
I loved him in it.
And he was really great.
Yeah, but the guy, I feel like if he had been, anyway, minor quibbles. I don't want to rain on this one because it's actually one I genuinely like. So it won't make my final list, but I would never trample on it because it was a lot of fun.
It is a lot of fun. And you know what?
And it feels original in its way.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and I'm very curious. I mean, I don't want to say why, but it's like, here's a straightforward, pretty simple concept for a movie, mm-hmm. and it's a hit. It's like, it's a huge hit. It's bringing a lot of money. And I'm curious why something like this is hitting right now, whereas something like, I don't know, Your Next was, maybe that was just something that was held for too long.
It could be the, I find Your Next actually really funny. Mm. So like,
but they didn't play that up in the trailer.
No, they didn't.
The trailer looks dead serious.
I mean, no, it is a serious thriller, but when you go back, it's funny because it's like the Swanberg jokes and the Ty West underground.
Yeah.
But this one is actually funny. Yeah, comedy, purposeful.
The trailer is funny, which is a risky venture because a lot of times they'll say things like, well, horror comedies don't sell. We cut them serious so that you think you're coming for the scare of your life. But this one, like, they show the crossbow stuff in the trailer. You see all of kind of everybody's ineptness in the trailer, which I mean is most of the first two acts, but that said, I think that that's what made the trailer so desirable was kind of the incorporation of horror comedy. So I hope we're actually seeing a shift back towards horror comedy, because for the past easily 10 years there's been such a push away from it.
And it's usually one that, this one's nice because it does start comedy and it does get darker as it got darker. I got more engaged. Mm. So I definitely, it's probably, you know, again, it's the trailer. Had I not seen that trailer and I walked into this blind, I probably would have walked out loving, because I wouldn't have seen any of those beats.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sometimes, you know, some movies retread the trailer more than others, and that one for me did quite a bit. So,
well, now I'm curious, because of how this did, how it will affect Rian Johnson's new movie Knives Out.
Yeah.
Which I am so excited about.
Yeah, I love mysteries.
Similar.
But it's probably more of a Perot mystery type
with
thing.
With a lot of big stars.
Yeah.
But
no, I'm sure he's good at mysteries and twists, so I'm excited to see what he has in store for us.
Yeah.
Because I didn't get much from that trailer. I was like, oh, okay, cool. You know, I couldn't tell. Whereas Ready or Not had a trailer that was better hook. Like, I was ooh, okay. But a lot of it is her talent, because like when they say, you know, go hide, and she's like, ooh, okay, how long do I have to hide for? Like, she's nailing those beats. So.
Yeah.
I did like it a lot.
All right. Well, what else have you guys seen?
Well, we hosted Satanic Panic.
Yes.
Oh, yeah,
we did.
Yeah. How did that happen? Because I didn't even know about that until I saw you guys on stage.
It was Rachel texted me about 24 hours prior and said, hey, want to moderate? And I said,
and there's going to be 12 or 15 people on stage.
Yeah. And then she sent me over the list and I was like, there's 17 people coming up, and they only had a 15-minute Q&A. So we extended it.
And she made me do it with her.
Yeah. And then I was like, let's call it a Shockwaves event.
We love Chelsea.
So yeah, but it was an absolute blast. The movie is a total trip. It's just batshit bonkers the whole time. Hyper gory, beautiful practical effects. So yeah, it's a trip. I had a blast with it.
Yeah, I think it's really funny. I think Jerry O'Connell kind of steals the show.
Oh my God, he does.
Well, I think AJ definitely. I think it's one of the best things AJ's done in terms of showing that other side of him, that's closer to the real AJ. Like, you know, seeing him in dark horror movies, I'm like, that doesn't, but goofy comedy, I'm like, yep,
that's AJ.
And them on stage was pretty funny. AJ was definitely ribbing him a bit, and there was a lot of throat punching talk from Jerry.
Yeah.
Jerry was pretty funny on stage, I thought, but it was a great house. Had a pact, and so look out for that, because that's my second time seeing it, but look out for it
it's
this weekend. It's
this
same
weekend.
Day as it. So you supporting it, supporting,
so please
Satanic
support
Panic on
indie
VOD
horror important. As well.
Capping off a good year for Chelsea, so that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And I only saw one other indie thing. Did you guys ever hear about this? Some of our – I actually have the Shockwaves group to thank for this one. It's an Arrow release. It's just so far up my alley. It's not even funny. It's called The Possessed. And it was
that is kind of funny.
It's a black and white – well, it's not because of the title, but yeah. It's a black and white giallo, early giallo, so it's like 65 or something. And it looks kind of like somewhere between a Bergman film and Antonioni. It's all like total art house shot, right? But it's still very much within that, like, I think it's – is that right before – The girl, it might be right after The Girl Who Knew Too Much. And it is a guy, a writer goes out to the Seaside Hotel where he remembered this beautiful woman from a year before. Turns out she's not there. Then he finds out she's died. So his reason for being there is a little in question. And then he starts to put together this weird mystery about all the people and what they're, who run the hotel and what their relationship to her was. It's got a great sense of like.
What year is this?
It's like 65, I think. It's really early. Wow. It's really early in this and it's gorgeous. It definitely strays more towards an art house movie than even a giallo film. But the cool thing is it's directed by one of the directors of one of my favorite giallos, which is The Fifth Chord, which also came out recently. But a couple of our people in the Shockwaves group just one day it posted up, and I'd seen the cover, and I was like, oh yeah, what is that thing? It reminded me, remember that Christopher Lee black and white movie that I talked about last year, and I think you ended up seeing it, where he's a professor in Maine, and the girl goes out to the hotel. It's a witch story. I think it's like The Living Dead or the...
Oh, City of the Dead.
City of the Dead. It has an aesthetic very close to that, but definitely more in line with like a persona or something, the way it's shot. So it's kind of experimental in that sense, but it's a really solid film, and it kind of, you know, crime, thriller, horror thing, but it has but here's the important part. Arrow, just in case you get confused, if you buy this, I blind bought it because of people talking about it, has a great soundtrack that's a very minimal and kind of eerie sound to it, but there's an Italian and an English version, and as soon as that always stresses me the hell out, because I go, oh, and they're not leaning you either way. So I had to do some deep dive before I push play, and I found somebody who had written at length about how they're actually quite different, but definitely to go with the Italian version, because the English one just tries to spell out too many things, and it's meant to be a little bit oblique. So I watched the Italian version, and then afterwards I kind of flicked through the English one and really liked it. I thought it definitely would be one of my discoveries of the year. It's not hard horror, so you know, you would go with this if you're more into on the art side of this kind of genre. But I liked it a lot. So thank you, whoever it was on the Shockwaves forum who posted it. And I own it. So if you want to borrow, you can borrow.
That sounds good.
Very cool.
So I shot a film. So that took up most of my weekend. So that was awesome.
We saw an amazing practical that I can't talk about.
Yeah, we had because we had one practical that was absolutely insane. It took up an entire day. So we had to shoot everything else and then hold for the practical. But we had Josh and Sierra Russell doing the effects on it. And they had done the ritual.
I voted for them for the ritual and they won.
Oh.
So, for the Fangoria Award.
Oh, okay. I was like, what?
I don't think I made that happen. I just voted for
Yeah, them. No, they were fantastic. And so I'm really excited to show everybody this one, produced by Rustic Films, who had done like The Endless and Spring. And
stop making excuses for not having watched movies.
What? No, that's why I didn't watch anything. No, actually, I did watch two things. So last week, Severin invited me to record some of the bonus features for Perdita Durango.
Oh, yeah.
I've always had... I cringe to say a fondness for, because the movie is just so fucking twisted and
it's
ugly.
An intense movie.
But I will say I've always been fascinated by the movie is probably a better way to put it. And this one is it's the same Barry Gifford strain of novels that Wild at Heart pulls from.
Lulu and Sailor,
Lulu and Sailor. And this particular story is taking from 59 Degrees and Raining, which is the story of Perdita Durango. And it's kind of a loose movie version of that same story about this horrible kind of crazy gangster woman named Perdita Durango. In the original book, she's a prostitute. In the movie, she's not. But just hardened street criminal, and who falls in love with this other street criminal, drug dealer named Romeo, and they kind of go on this road trip together to deliver a black market truckload of human fetuses that are being sold for makeup.
And it's Javier Bardem, and that was the first time I'd seen him, and it
was the first time most of us saw him.
A hell of a launch, because he's as scary as his character in No Country for Old Men.
Yeah, he is absolutely terrifying in this movie. Somehow sexy, too, which is really weird. Like the movie, and this was part of the problem why few people have heard of Perdita Durango. It was made by Alex D'Iglesia, And this was supposed to be his stateside debut. This was supposed to be his big film that would make him known in the States, because he'd been doing stuff in Europe for a while. And so everyone was like, okay, well, this is going to be his big film. But when you look at the content of Perdita Durango, in addition to the truckload of fetuses, there's multiple rape scenes, probably three or four. There's all of these. They call it Santeria, but it's definitely some type of like a black magic ritual where they're literally like humping bodies. They hack something's limbs off. He gets possessed, does cocaine, drinks blood. Like, it's crazy shit. Not Santeria. It's this very kind of weird black magic-y thing, even though they're saying it is. And then it's got just all of this other heinous violence. Rosie Perez is naked for a while. There's some weird stuff with a tiger. Like, the movie itself is just this crazy mixture of horrible acts where we're watching Javier Bardem rape people. And then in the next scene, he's dancing to Herb Alpert. And so it's just this weird comedy, because it is kind of portrayed as a comedy. And the villains, who are Rosie Perez and Javier Bardem, Perdita and Romeo, they're the villains, but they're the heroes. And the two college kids that they abduct, who I think we're supposed to kind of side with, are just weak and horrible, and
actually,
no one likes them.
You just brought something up that reminds me, it is a bit like Devil's Rejects, yep. Way before Devil's Rejects. Like,
exactly.
It is, you are stuck with them.
But it's Devil's Rejects as if it was a comedy. Mm-hmm. And they were doing deplorable acts, even more so than you see in Devil's Rejects to a degree. And then, you know, the next scene is actually shot like kind of like a screwball comedy. And then it's got James Gandolfini, who gets hit with a car and in the face like six times throughout the course of the movie. Like, I don't know how the man is standing by the end. So yeah, it's a weird, convoluted movie. And even though this was supposed to be Alex de Iglesias' big break, what ended up happening was his Spanish fans thought that he had gone full Hollywood and didn't like it, whereas American audiences went, what the hell is this?
Did it even come out here?
No. So they tried to get
– Center Dance with the Devil.
And it took 2 years to get that. It was originally made in 1997, and it did not get any type of release until 1999, and then it was put under the title Dance with the Devil, and it just got buried. It was a really limited DVD release.
Highly edited too, right?
Highly edited. They ended up cutting 10 full minutes out of the film, mostly from the rape scenes and a little bit from the drug-fueled black magic action. But there's a scene where Javier Bardem and Perdita Durango have very graphic sex with a dismembered, rotting head. And that got kind
of... White Man Can't Jump.
I know, it's just like White Man Can't Jump. It's basically Untamed Heart with a head.
Put your mouth where the money is. Wow.
That's what I remember.
So it's just this questionable film, but there's something about it that I'm fascinated by. So I got to speak on it at length, and I got to revisit it, and it's still just as weird and wacky and convoluted as when I saw it the first time. But Severin is doing a Blu-ray release of it, so I'm glad that other people will finally get to see it. I will say, this is not for the novice film fan. This is for the, you want to see some crazy shit, check out Perdita Durango. So,
wow.
Yeah. So that's Perdita Durango.
Nice.
Well, if you want to do an intense double feature, and I know Elric does.
Weekend of Bernie's Hellraiser 3.
Two discs have come out since last I was on the show, both of which I've been pretty a big fan of. From Arrow, we finally got Cruisin' on Blu-ray.
Yeah.
William Friedkin's 1980 gay serial killer in New York movie. It is quite something. I'd only seen bits and pieces of it, but this was wow.
Oh yeah.
I mean, what can we say about Cruisin'?
People don't talk enough about that. It's actually scary.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah,
it actually operates well as a horror film, which is like, I think people often like have more fun. There's a lot of fun and a lot of gifing being made, but there is, well, last time I saw it in a theater there, when it gets to this like whispering killer and you're meeting, like watching how dangerous sex was for some of the people, the way they were having sex and the way they were cruising, you really, for me, I felt very empathetic to what they're going through because it's scary. Like, I realize you're so at risk. And it's pre-AIDS being discussed.
Yes.
Yeah. But it's totally a film that literally nails better than even Cronenberg stuff, in my opinion, like Rabbit, Shivers and Rabbit. I think this gets at this weird this like this somebody something's just happening and people are disappearing and dying.
It's this whole it's like a whisper. Yeah. It's like this whole whispered society that is at risk and is struggling and is being preyed upon, but no one can say anything out loud. And so yeah, it's really powerful in that regard.
And it's creepy what he's saying. Like, I'm here, you're here, we're here. It's just like, I don't want the and Powers Booth, you know.
Yeah, oh my God. And yeah, they do quote. They do a lot of well the transfer look, it's a 4K restoration and the transfer looks terrific. So the disc looks great. People complain a little bit about no like brand new special features, but that said, because sometimes there's these weird rules about licensing from certain studios where you're not allowed to create new material. So I'm just going to take a guess, and assume that that's what happened here. But the stuff that is on here, I mean, again, I'd never gotten a DVD of it or anything like that. So all the archival material, I think there's a commentary with Friedkin. There's some, behind the scenes stuff, like archival interviews and featurettes from when they made the movie. And like when the gay community found out about it, they like were protesting and basically making a ton of noise so they would ruin their takes when like Pacino's in a diner with one of his characters or whatever, and it's like it's pretty incredible. I just I was very blown away by it overall in general, and the fact that it exists, and more than anything how Friedkin is ambiguous with the killer meaning, and it's subtle, but it, like in certain scenes, because obviously you don't see the killer, It looks like it might even be different actors throughout.
Yeah, it's hard to talk about without like totally spoiling, but completely. Like, yeah, and I know it's like it's an old movie, so but because it's got this new release, it's probably going to reach a lot of people. But yeah, I think that's where the
that's part of the idea,
parable of like if it's a representation of AIDS or something early, it's shifting and it's moving, and they definitely were shooting different people in there. It makes it way creepier. When I first saw it when I was young, I just thought it was because I just watched all the Pacino movies, you know, I thought it was kind of shocking, and especially where it goes with his character. I remember going, whoa, they make some really interesting ambiguous choices about where he goes. But then watching it as an adult, I found it to be a lot scarier as a horror film. And it's just a really good movie. And also it's not, wouldn't have been an easy movie to make. I mean,
no, I'm sure.
He made it in all the real bars and
that's my fun fact from cruising. I lived for 5 years above the bar, the leather bar that they use
in
there.
The meatpacking district?
No, it's Chelsea. Okay. It's on 8th Avenue. And I lived directly above it for 5 years. And it was still a leather bar at the time. It's not a leather bar. I think it's a Qdoba now.
Well, that's why
Starbucks.
They called you Mistress Becker.
No. Actually, they had $2 beers. I was always so tempted because they would put out this sign that said $2 beers, but yeah,
that's fine.
Well, so that's the cruising Blu-ray that Arrow put out. Spectacular. And if you go just 2 years later and go to the other coast, if you want to be in LA and see a really sleazy version of that, Scream Factory just put out Vice Squad.
Haven't heard of it.
Really?
No, I'm
pretty sure you have.
I will.
I think
sing
he's vaguely
neon,
familiar.
I will sing Neon Slime for you if you want.
Yeah, this is.
I haven't watched the Blu-ray yet.
Holy smokes.
I know.
This is something else. I don't know how movies like this can get made. This is Gary Sherman. It is about a character named Ramrod, who is a white pimp.
Well, we had Gary here once, and we talked to Gary way back when about.
But it'd been a long time since I'd seen it.
Oh, yeah.
And now that it's in a pristine.
Don't you think he's kind of like watching it this last time? I unfortunately didn't have the transfer in time for Chattanooga when I announced it. I kept thinking it's like the Terminator.
Oh my God.
He's literally like, or Commando, you know, the Commando great scene where he crashes his car and just gets out straight away. It feels like that.
He's a pimp out of control.
Ramrod.
That's Ramrod.
But I'm
on
still
the loose.
Haunted by Gary Sherman telling us that story where he started investigating what pimps were like. He started talking to real pimps, and he talked to a black pimp who said to him, oh, in this world, there is nothing more dangerous or brutal or ugly as a white pimp, and explained why. And so he took that research and put it into Ramrod. And I find that to be really just fascinating.
Incredible.
Because it is, you know, he's saying because it's a life choice.
Yeah.
They weren't growing up in this world where they needed to do it. They choose to be a pimp and exploit people around them. And I just think it's one of the greatest performances. It's so much fun.
Yeah.
I can't wait to watch something. It on Blue suddenly.
Yeah. Come on over. Let's have a cruise in Vice Squad night.
Actually, no, you're right. That is a pretty damn
and
good
And maybe
double.
Throw in Strip to Kill, because why not?
and while we're at it, I would end with Fear City.
Abel Ferrara's Fear City,
which is basically it's very much like 10 to Midnight.
I've never seen Fear City.
But shot in New York. It even has a naked killer in the same way. but it's got Tom Berenger and I believe Billy Dee But it's an Abel Ferrara film that doesn't get as much love. It's you know, a little more for entertainment, but the sleaze factor is off the charts. It's definitely a pair perfect with 10 to Midnight. Those two have a lot of similarities.
Huh, interesting.
And has some good music on it too.
It looks like there's a Blu-ray from
Shout?
Not from Shout, from a foreign company called Cinema Cult.
Okay.
It's a region B. So anyways, well, that sounds fun.
Speaking of sleazy. Well, you know, there's a lot of neon and sleaze in the movie with one of our guests coming up in a second.
All right.
Some night work coming up. We'll be back in a second.
This episode is brought to you by Fright Rags. Fright Rags is the number one source for horror t-shirts. With specially curated collections created by renowned horror artists, they offer the best art and the best quality anywhere. Brand new today, Fright Rags has released a special limited edition t-shirt for the upcoming Creepshow TV series, debuting later this month on Shudder. Designed by Nathan Thomas Millier, this shirt puts a modern twist on the classic Creepshow comic book cover. But hurry, it's limited to only 300 and will sell out quickly. And then stay tuned on Tuesday, September 10th for their exclusive collection of shirts from Rob Zombie's Three from Hell. Listeners get 10% off their first order with the code WAVES10. That's WAVES10. Again, that's 10% off by using that code at fright-rags.com.
Tonight's episode of Shockwaves is also brought to you by Slasher Crasher, the debut horror comedy novel of David Nora. The night he tried to go home, but he got caught in their drama. It's Halloween, and Nick Roche is a towering figure of evil and stupidity. He escapes from an upstate New York mental hospital he's been committed to for the past 5 years, planning to return to his childhood home where he brutally murdered his babysitter's boyfriend. His plans are halted when he crosses paths with an even more terrifying beast, two high school best friends with some serious beef. Caught in a battle of loyalty that's been brewing for 10 years of their friendship, the two girls, Kathleen Strife and Betsy Coleman, force the feud into a savage showdown, pitting the escaped monster against each other. Who will survive this epic death match? And it's totally wrong to fall in love with a murderous lunatic who just tried to kill your ex-best friend with a machete. It's available on Amazon, at BarnesandNoble.com, and at BlackRoseWriting.com. For more info, you can find David Nora on Twitter and Instagram at David Nora Jr. Again, the novel is called Slasher Crasher.
Tonight's show is also brought to you by Wellgo USA and their amazing new releases. First up is Freaks. They Look Just Like Us. Bruce Dern, Emile Hirsch, and Amanda Crew star in the genre-bending psychological sci-fi thriller Freaks. In theaters this Friday 13th, don't miss the film that critics are calling visually stunning, gripping, and a whole different level. Also, they have the Phantasm Sphere Collection. The Sphere is back and scarier than ever. One of the world's most popular franchises in the history of horror, the Phantasm film series has terrified fans for generations. Now get the exclusive Phantasm Sphere Collection loaded with never-before-seen bonus features and an actual Phantasm Sphere replica. Look for it at Halloween. Boy! Welcome back, and we are here with the victors who are drinking out of the skulls of all their victims from Fright Fest. The victors of Fright Fest.
Is there a video of that?
I don't know. I don't know if you actually beat other people or if you just win, but I don't even know what you won. But Joe Bigas and Josh Ethier, who have been on Killer POV way back, and yes. Joe Bigas was with Graham Skipper.
Live from my
kind of a
living
drunken
room.
House.
Yeah.
But congrats, dudes.
Thank you.
Two movies back to back.
Well, yeah. Wow. So there's a couple reasons. I mean, the timeliness. But I saw Bliss with you in Chicago and had a blast. What was that called? That
Cinepocalypse
was super cool. And knew you had shot VFW, so we'll get into that. But just yesterday, it was announced that you double feature playing at Beyond Fest.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's going to be fucking awesome, man. Bliss is on 35mm.
Oh, yeah, are you allowed to talk about how that happened?
Yeah, I had so many questions because it's so hard to shoot on 35mm now. How did you get insurance
for
it?
We shot on 16, and we printed to 35.
Oh, my gosh. Was the insurance still crazy because of that?
No, it was like I paid like $3,000 for our insurance policy.
Oh my gosh. Every single person I know.
We shouldn't have a bond company, so.
Everyone I know that's tried to shoot on 35 has immediately been told, like, no, it's this price. Maybe 16's a little bit better. But yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, everybody was telling us not to do it. They said it was a bad idea. It was way too expensive. It probably cost us about $25,000 all in and exponentially raised the production value of the movie. And it was incredibly easy. Our entire camera crew was one dude who was our film loader, my focus puller, and our second AC. And, you know, nine fucking kind of low-grade scumbags made a movie on 16mm in L.A., and it was super easy. So anybody who says otherwise, I feel like doesn't know what they're talking
about. Yeah, what was the main difference? Because I remember seeing you guys day one, which was, like, really cool because it actually got me super inspired because you were filming that first day where I work. But just the way you were approaching it, like, no one had shot on film before. Even the DP hadn't really.
He had before.
Okay, right.
Yeah, Mike tested it, actually. Yeah, Mike, directed a film on 16.
Okay.
Oh, really?
Browse. Yeah.
Oh. And so but I love difference. Like the way everyone was approaching is just like, it'll be the same. It'll be fine. And it was like, but what was like, what actually made you want to do? I mean, because I probably will have the same reasoning because you're standing out now. That's the interesting thing. Like this actually makes the image quality stand out.
Yeah. Well, the thing is this movie is a lot less of a budget than my last one. And because I was kind of going down in budget, I wanted to do something that I was going to push myself to make the movie feel bigger or do things that I wanted to do. And I always wanted to shoot on 16mm, even though everybody's telling me not to. And, you know, as much as people said, it's not worth it, it's not worth the thing, I wouldn't know if it was worth it or not until I actually did it. Mm-hmm. So if I failed and it sucked, I'd be like, okay, never shooting on 16 again. If it was awesome, I'd be like, well, it was fucking awesome. It's exactly what I expected it to be. And I think just because it was a lower budget thing, it's like, all right, how can I push this forward? How can I push my craft forward? How can I, you know, just push the entire crew forward and make something that's going to feel bigger and more accomplished than my last movie, even though we got half the budget. So right from the gate, it was like, however much 16 costs, we'll build the rest of the budget around that because it's super necessary to
do. It felt to me like twice the budget of your last movie.
Yeah, I agree.
You know what I mean? Like, and it's, I mean, it's super focused. Focused, you know, which you probably have to be, and also suits the kind of movie because it's definitely more like your Ferrera, like gritty. You're following the character, and the character is like a female version of you, which is like I know you've talked about that at Q&A, but it is you have to watch the movie to get that, which is funny.
Well, also a lot of people say the character is really abrasive and unlikable. So
yeah, no, they totally nail it. You're more of a sweetheart probably, but it's you know it's I think it's largely a film about the artistic process. And that obsessive, I always think that Stan Brakhage's Mothlight was, you know, as this idea of what filmmakers are like to film, that it's like moth to a light, we burn up and we're willing to sacrifice ourselves for that art, no matter what the chances of succeeding. And that's what your film's about for a painter, and she's willing to go all the way with this art.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And I feel like that's, you know, I was kind of in that position where I just really wanted to fucking make something and I wanted to do something. I was like so angry that I couldn't get anything going. So I was like, I'm going to go do another fucking small movie. Like I did Almost Human again. I'm just going to do it in LA really tiny and I'm going to make it about an artist who's really struggling, but you know, I'll make it a female painter instead of a male screenwriter sitting in his apartment, you know, tooling away in his MacBook Pro. nobody wants to fucking watch that. So that's kind of where it came from.
You still have friends in it, you know? Is Graham the drug dealer in that?
Yeah, yeah.
Graham Skipper's in there and Jeremy Gardner's in there as a boyfriend character.
Oh, nice.
I'm trying to think.
A whole bunch of Reanimated the Musical.
Right.
People that Joe had worked with in
I
the
like
past.
Jesse and mm-hmm. nice.
Jesse Merlin and
Josh is in it.
But I will say, like, I guess McKenna. For me, the reason it feels free, like, I mean, you know, like you could say anything, but for me, it actually felt like a big step for you artistically because I think the choice, not just the film, I think it was the choice of the lead because all the other films so far, for the most part, have been either friends or people you know in the lead and everyone's good, but there's something about what she's able to do. It feels like more like a new relationship that you're just discovering through watching you with this actress, which I think because it's so
what's
focused.
Her name again? Dora?
Yeah, Dora Madison. Dora. She was on Friday Night Lights.
Yeah. And, she was on Dexter the last season.
Yep, for a little bit. Chicago yeah. Fire and yeah, so she was a TV, you know, she did a lot of big TV. And I think maybe that's somewhere where she came from too. She was doing all this network TV that she hated. And then she ended up getting fired from her last job. And she just wanted to do something that was like super pure art kind of. And we were both kind of at that same point. So I think it was a nice, just kind of a nice relationship. And she hung out with me beforehand and kind of realized that she was playing me, so it ended up working out. She
raided assimilated his closet. And,
oh, really? Oh, see, sure.
Like, yeah, everything in the movie is my clothes.
Oh, she's wearing a Death Waltz record shirt.
That's my
shirt.
Oh, that's awesome.
It's my fucking shirt.
Yeah, we had to fight to get it back, actually.
Oh, really? And your role on this one, you weren't just, because I remember day one, you were like in there producing as well as editing. You've always been a producer on most of Joe's films.
Yeah, so. No, I've been Joe's producing partner since the beginning. On this one, weirdly, I was the first AD, mm-hmm. which was fun. Because Joe is just like this straight locomotive heading for the goal every time we get on set. So we always have a problem with first ADs because you're like, he won't listen to me. And I was like, well, he's not going to listen to me either, but at least I know, like, you know, how much
money shield him,
how much money is in the bank account and like what shots we'll need to get through. So the entire AD department was just me and our friend Matt Mercer.
Yeah.
It was like this incredibly small group of just friends.
Yeah.
And we didn't have to have any arguments and we didn't have to clear anything with anybody. Same thing with like the 16 millimeter discussion. It wasn't like we were trying to convince a producer it was worth doing. Yeah. It was Joe saying, I want to shoot on 16. And then we crunch the numbers and we make it work.
Yeah.
And the whole movie ended up like that. That's why, you know, we're incredibly proud of that one because that feels the most like it came from, you know, Joe's experience and also utilizes all of the tools and benefits that we have with both our camera department that we've always used, our mixer on that, who's now done VFW, who worked with me on my short. Like, everybody really came together. Nobody was going to get rich off of it, but just wanted to make something cool. And it really shows in the movie.
The part that struck me is I assumed it would have been more challenging because you've got some sunset shots where, like, when the sun's going, she drives around a lot. I love that stuff because it actually – I always feel like L.A. needs to be on film to look like L.A. That's why I like Quentin's new film so much because it feels like L.A. Whereas if it had been digital, I always feel like when I see, like, any digital shot film, you know, maybe Michael Mann's Collateral is a little mix of film and digital, but it just doesn't look right to me.
Well, the thing about film is with digital, you can never, ever shoot daytime exteriors to look correct because the sun's always a fucking issue. The colors blow out, like, just that big giant, you know, 1,000K light basically facing your lens all the time is going to fuck everything up. So I know you guys haven't seen the movie, but there's this shot where the lead's in front of this big giant bank of windows and the sun is literally setting behind her and you could see the exact outline of the sun setting and you could see her face completely exposed and we were just literally shooting against her. We had no other lights in there. We're just shooting it as is, and if you shot that on digital, like, the entire windows would be completely blown out.
You'd
never see, like, her face would get a light on it and it would just look really, like, pastel-y. And that's the thing. I mean, with nighttime, you can make digital look pretty good, but it's fucking daytime exteriors that you could never, ever get right. And when I look at trailers for movies, it's like the daytime exteriors, how the sun looks, how the clouds look, as opposed to how the textures on the face look. That's when you know it's shot on film or digital. So, like, because I wanted this entire movie, it takes place 75% at night, but the daytime stuff, I wanted to be magic hour, the sun setting in L.A., John McTiernan, L.A., and you literally wouldn't have been able to get that on digital. You would have had to, like, falsify it a lot and make it orange, and it would have looked sun-baked, and it would have just looked...
But were the nights more tricky? Because that's what I was getting at, because, like, how much do you have to push that to capture
lenses are just so fucking fast now. Yeah. We're shooting on the 1.3s, and a lot of that, we're just roaming around the city, and we're able to get a lot of that stuff. And we shot on this... these Astera lights that are basically, they look like fluorescent lights, like long tubes, and they're battery powered and they're super powerful. And my gaffer's like, man, I thought this movie was just going to be like, you know, little dots basically against black, but the movie's all really well exposed.
Yeah.
And we shot super, super low light. Like, we shot VFW with the same lighting package. And I mean, the red going to 16 millimeter, it wasn't really that big of a difference at all.
Yeah. The other thing that in movies like this always get do terribly is when there's an artist or a poet or a writer and then they read their stuff and it's shit, or the poet, you know what I mean? But in this, the painting, you put a lot of time to actually create, because it's all about this, you know, I don't want to really spoil the story, but, you know, it deals with vampirism, it deals with, there's a lot of sex, it deals with blackouts that result in your artistic, kind of like, you know, I know Naked Lunch, you know, William Esparza doesn't remember a single second of having written that book. Like, he just doesn't have any memory of it because of his heroin.
That makes sense.
Yeah, no, exactly. But it got made, right? And so I think you actually deliver in this film with the art of it.
Did you hire an artist to do all the art on it, or?
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, I'm a shitty artist, as much as I'd like to be a good painter, but this guy Chet Czar, who I'm a huge fan of, I met him at a festival, and he designed, like, Darkman, basically, and he does basically he's just an artist now. He's designed a lot of stuff for Clive Barker in the past, but now he Guillermo del Toro's exhibit in LA had like 10 of his pieces up because he does a bunch of stuff for Guillermo.
It definitely reminded me of a little Barker in a way. Yeah. You know?
And that's actually where the movie came from.
Hyena Gallery. He's one of their artists, but yeah, he's great.
Yeah, he's fucking amazing. And Clive Barker was like a big influence on the story too, just like the LA artist kind of struggling. Mm-hmm. I love that aspect of it. But I met Chet at a festival like 3 or 4 years ago. He had an installation there and I became kind of friendly with him. And when I wrote this, I knew that that's the direction I wanted to go in. And I figured I'd just write it hoping he would do it. And I reached out to him and he basically turned it down without reading the script. And I was like, just read the fucking script, man, and then tell me what you think. And he read it and he's like, oh yeah, this is super cool. This is awesome. We met and I had like a very basic idea of what I wanted the painting to be. And he took it from there and, you know, elevated it and put his own style on it. And then what we did, because she's painting like an 8x6 giant wall-sized painting, he was like, well, first off, she, you know, I can't paint that and 2 months or 6 weeks or whatever. So what we did was he painted it, you know, on a little piece, I don't know, like 2x3 feet or whatever. And he would photograph it every 2 days. And then I got to decide, oh, I like this stage, this stage. We printed it to canvas. He painted over it so it had texture. Mm. It looked fucking awesome. And like, so we shot it in sequence too. So as she's painting, we just came out, we switched canvases out. So it looks like she's actually going through the process of painting this awesome painting. And then because Chet's such a good artist, when you get to the end of the movie, it's like, oh yeah, that's a good piece of art. It's not like she was just, you know, some bullshit that fucking somebody scribbled out. It looks fucking amazing. So, you know, if we didn't have a good artist doing that, the movie really would have fizzled out at the end with this dinky ass drawing.
Yeah, no, you have to deliver that, especially how bold it goes into her, like, you know, just destruction, you know? And I said, probably after the thing, the last 20, 30 minutes is just like pure, it's just going for it. And I love that about any movie that goes there, where it just drops narrative and just goes for the, you know, the emotion.
I wanted to do that earlier in the movie, but I figured it might, you know, it would probably get
your AD stopped you. Your AD said, not yet, young one. So what happened? So before we move on to the other one, because I'm very curious how that one came about, what is, besides obviously film festivals, has this one sold? Do we know where people are going to get to see this besides this?
Yeah, Dark Sky's putting it out September 27th.
Oh, nice.
Oh, cool.
So, okay, so actually it's playing at Beyond Fest on October 5th after it comes out.
Okay.
And I pushed really hard the distributor, you know, I was like, oh, we should open up in LA. And I'm like, yeah, but we can play at Beyond Fest on 35 fucking millimeter. Like,
right. So you're
I'd
not
rather do that.
Yeah, yeah, so that does sound much cooler.
Because you only have one print, I guess, right?
Yeah, yeah. And it'll double it with, it's going to be double the VFW. So, I mean, I'd rather have that cool night than, you know, play at whatever, a music box or whatever.
So you made a film with William Sadler.
Yeah.
How the hell did this movie happen? Like, how the hell did you guys get this crazy, like, because obviously this is the first one, I don't know a lot about it yet.
This is the Fangoria film,
yeah, it's a Fangoria film. You have some of the most amazing, you know, character actors popping up in this thing, and it sounds like it's a different joint. So just tell us how this happened.
Well, Dallas Sanye, who's the producer and
Rob's boss,
runs Fangoria, used to be my manager way back when. He saw Almost Human actually before it was ever like at Toronto or anything, and signed me as his client. Was like, you know, I think we should work together.
Did he meet you at? Was it Arclight or something funny like that?
No, some dude who worked at Arclight was like pushing his stuff to Dallas, and Dallas was like, this guy's not that good.
Yeah.
And then the guy passed my name along, thankfully, and Dallas watched the trailer and brought me in for a meeting, and then I showed him the movie, and he was into it.
Oh, thanks, Graham Skipper, for doing that. Yeah.
But yeah, so he pushed for, you know, Almost Human to get into festivals and get a release and all that stuff, and then soon after that, he became a producer on his own, and I kept on telling him, you know, we gotta fucking make something. We gotta make something. And it just took, I don't know, however long until he got, you know, Fangoria, that he had a script that I actually thought I would be interested in making. Mm-hmm. And that was VFW. So that actually happened before. So it was weird because I wrote Bliss and like I was sort of kind of starting to write it. And then Dallas sent me like all these scripts. You know, he's like, oh, we're doing Fangoria. We're going to, you know, launch all these movies. He sent me a few scripts. And VFW is the only one I liked. And I was like, oh, I like this one. Continued to write Bliss. And then he's like, all right, let's make it happen. I signed on to it, but they weren't ready to make it like right that second. I had to do rewrites, and they had Satanic Panic and a couple other things on the plate. And I called up. I'm like, hey, I just got money for this movie Bliss, so whatever plans you have for VFW, put them aside for at least 3 months. You know, we'll shoot the movie, and if we have to cut it later, we will. And he's like, yeah, cool. That sounds good. We'll make Satanic Panic first. So I basically raced through Bliss knowing that hopefully VFW would happen, you know. It seemed likely, but, you know, I've been attached to other movies that just never fucking happened. So I was just making Bliss as fast as I could, just in case VFW did happen. And it turns out that you know, they made Satanic Panic. We got VFW going. We ended up getting a really, really fucking awesome cast. And like as we were prepping VFW, Bliss got into Tribeca. So I was in Dallas and Josh was – I was flying back a couple of weekends to try and finish Bliss. Josh was still in L.A., then came to Dallas for the VFW shoot. And we were literally finishing Bliss while we were shooting VFW, left the set of VFW to premiere it at Tribeca. And then came back to shoot more of VFW.
You forgot that there were tornadoes going on in Texas at the same time, which we were flying in because we were heading to Texas Frightmare.
We were going to come to set, but then Graham was like, the weather's been really bad. Everyone's really tense right now because we're in the like the last 2 days.
He's like, we're backed up because there's been tornadoes and stuff, so we didn't come to set.
Fucking stupid rule that I'd never heard about where apparently if there's a thunderstorm within 5 miles of the set, you need to shut down for 30 minutes. So
wait,
like,
what?
Interesting.
Yeah, because we're running off of generators. So yeah,
is that just a Texas talk about a fucking rule, nightmare. Or
I don't know? It's a union rule. We weren't a union movie, but we had to follow the union rules.
Okay. But what is the movie about? Because like I know a little bit, but just like what's the hook of it, and why have we got these great character actors in it, and who are they?
It's a siege movie, much like Assault on Precinct 13, something like that. And it's kind of like, I don't know. It's a punk gang taking on these old vets, so it's kind of like this new – it's my favorite type of characters in movies. You know, it's punk gangs and Vietnam vets.
who are either, the vets? Tell us who the vets are.
When it's just one of those groups of people in a movie, it's fucking awesome. It's getting them across each other's – or going against each other's fucking the best. But Stephen Lang's the head.
What is the punk gang's motivation for attacking the veterans?
They have this new drug called Hype. Drugs. It's like this blue
Viper?
Blue powder that you snort and
soy sauce.
It's like RoboCop 2 essentially.
Got it. You had me at RoboCop 2.
Everything I read about it kept using the word mutant, and I was like, what's the mutant mean? Is that what after they
take
drugs?
Yeah, they're just all fucked up. Like, not as extreme as Hills Have Eyes because, you know, unfortunately, we don't have the time and budget to do that. But they start to look
all fucked up.
A little like meth on steroids at some points.
We kept having to tell all the extras because they were doing like.
Yeah, they're not zombies. They like
the zombie thing.
We're
like, you're not zombies. You're really. Essentially, you're opioid addicts, but like on speed.
Okay, interesting. But who are you? So, besides Sadler, because I remember a couple of people, I was like, holy shit.
Fred Williams.
Yeah, that was.
That's a great.
Doesn't he always say he never gets to die in movies? Don't spoil it, obviously. But remember that Larry Cohen, or it was some exploitation. He goes, I never died in a movie, even though it's total bullshit.
That was King Cohen.
Yeah, it's total bullshit because he has, but he's like, no, I never died in a movie, and I'm like, oh well.
I can name like three that you
know. I know exactly, right? But who else?
After the movie comes out, we should come back on and we'll tell you the story of Fred Williams wanting to die or not die.
Nice. Yeah.
We also have Martin Cove from, First Blood Part 2 and Karate Kid and Cobra Kai.
The ultimate villain.
David Patrick Kelly, Warriors, The Crow, Last Man Standing, and George Wendt.
George.
Yeah. Those are the six vets. Although Fred Williamson's a Korean War vet, but somehow looks younger than most of them. He's actually 80, but like he's legitimately 81.
Are you serious?
Yeah. And he was doing all of his own stunts like – you know, I was like, Fred, we're going to bust this chair over you. And he's like, well, better get it right the first time. Ultimately, we did it twice. So
what's the Fede movie that Stephen Lang was in?
Don't Breathe.
Don't Breathe. So for people, if you don't recognize his name, you've seen him in everything, obviously, the Avatar movies.
Tombstone, Manhunter.
It's funny because when I saw Avatar, I remember going, oh, that feels like a Michael Biehn role. And then you start researching and realize, oh, Stephen Lang almost had the Aliens role in, I think, Biehn, I think he had to bow out, and then Biehn got the role. And then the same thing, I think, happened. I think Biehn didn't get the role in Avatar, and Lang took it. So I think they've got this weird career parallel.
They're also really good friends, apparently.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah, I heard they're not friends. But Lang's great. He's a great actor.
He's incredible. He's amazing to work with. He's easily the best physical actor that we've ever had in one of our films.
Yeah.
Guy is a monster.
So, I think one of the reasons I love you always be on the show when we've done it over the years is just like the kind of inspiration factor for people trying to just go and do it. But like, this is like a leap in terms of the kind of people you have to direct or, you know, the kind of level. Did it feel different to you having to like work with these guys, or did you just have to be, you know, more organized? What did you feel?
It was definitely my biggest anxiety about making a movie. You know, I could shoot action. I've shot action a ton of times, effects a ton of times. But it was not only having, you know, seven or eight people on screen that you have to stage and block in a scene, which is fucking really hard to do, especially figuring out camera direction, like how can I make this interesting and all these guys got to be in frame. And that's harder to me than shooting action and effects. So super nervous about that because I've never done eight people in, you know, 60% of the movie. And then on top of that, the eight people have like a collective of 300 years of experience. So, you know, and then I look like I do and I'm going in there operating the camera. Like,
yeah. no script supervisor.
Yeah,
I
had the script supervisor removed from the production because we needed money elsewhere. And I was like, Josh is there, I'm there. We know what we're doing. We'll figure it out.
Lang goes to ask about it. And Joe goes, yeah, no, we don't have a script supervisor. You can just ask Josh. He's got the script with him. And Lang just turns to Joe and goes, this is really fucking cool. Like, this is like in the 70s, you know?
He's like, oh, do you need marks, Joe? I'm like, nah, it's cool. We will pull focus. We'll find focus.
This is everything I tell my students never to do.
Yeah.
It's wonderful. Yeah, love it.
Yeah, my crew, that's why I work with some of the same people, because, like, you know, if they're not used to me, they'll be like, God, this guy's a fucking maniac.
Yeah.
Which is exactly what the Dallas crew thinks.
So, going from movies that you're doing of your own accord to working with a producer, and suddenly you're now like not a director for hire, but you're being brought in by this company to deliver a product for them. Was there a difference there, or was it still kind of like making your own movie the way that you want?
So the weirdest thing about making this was that I didn't write it. It's a lot harder to familiarize yourself with the material when you didn't write it, because when I write, I think of things in shots and scenes and literally blocking in my head. So to come in from something from the top down like that and kind of familiarize myself with it was challenging. I did, you know, I rewrote, I added the whole mutant punk thing and did do some stuff to the script, but ultimately
it
wasn't
my script.
Wait, if
you added that, what were they up against?
It was just a gang before. Oh, okay. I wanted to make something that was a little more visual.
Yeah.
But coming in from the top down like that, it was really hard to inform myself with everything. And that was difficult to get into. Though, you know, in the changes I wanted to do, like I changed the hangout to an old abandoned movie theater as opposed to the original script. So they let me do like all these kind of stuff like that and make it mine as much as possible. Once we got on set, it felt like I was making my own movie again. Mm. My core crew members were there. Josh was there. And, you know, there wasn't anything on set that they said, no, you can't do that. And in fact, actually, there was times when department heads would tell me no. And then Dallas or Amanda, the producers, would be like, no, fuck that. How can we make that happen? And they made it happen. So that was really awesome.
So they wanted you to make it your movie.
Yeah.
They were insulating you to make
it. Yeah. They were attracted to the whole, both the script itself lends itself to all the stuff that Joe has proven to be really good at, and that our crew has been able to handle in really, you know, short time frames with limited budget and limited equipment. So when they asked him to do it, they brought me on as a producer. We've got the Channel 83 logo up there. They were incredibly open about budget. They said, we know that you guys have done this for less. Look at this and show us how you did it. You know, let's pool every available resource. And they were amazing to work with. And I'd worked with them on 3 or 4 films as an editor. Obviously, Dallas has been a good friend of Joe's for years. I've been friends with Amanda because I've been on those films. So there was never anything that was like taboo subject. Yeah. It was a nice open conversation. And at the end of the day, everyone just wanted to make the best movie possible.
Nice. And so has it been seen at all yet?
Josh actually just delivered the file today to get QC'd. So
no one's seen the final version except
the final version because, we finished it this weekend. So yeah.
Nice.
And I kept refusing to watch. I want to see it finished.
I invited Elric over literally like 4 times, and he had cooler things to do than come over and get drunk and watch VFW.
I think I want to see it. I'm going to see it the best possible way, right?
Beyond Fest?
Yeah, we'll see. If you show up.
You don't believe in me.
I'll tell you, the Egyptian Theater would be a hell of a place to see it.
Oh, yeah.
It's easily the best projection in the city.
I got an editing question for you because I'm curious. I remember Walter Murch always made a big deal of like editors never to be on set, never to see the people in their historic garbs. It's like, fuck all that shit. Like, I don't want to know how hard the shark was. I just want to, you know, see what I've got, right?
Yeah.
But I imagine for most of the movies you work on, that's the case.
Yeah, for a lot of stuff, I'm not on set. I might just go visit and just introduce myself to department heads. You know, typically sound guys and DITs, because those are the ones that most have to do with me. But on Joe's movies, there's never any problem, you know, disconnecting it.
Yeah.
Especially because, at least in... Actually, in all 4 of them now, I've had to edit myself.
Right.
And it's always like, well, I know I look stupid, but it has to be in the movie, so obviously there's no adjustment to be made. But it doesn't really change on set, just because that's how we've always worked.
Yeah.
And everything is wide open in the editing room. Like, whatever's best for the movie is best, and him and I have no problems about that. Editing has become very easy. It's more or less just hanging out.
Yeah.
Even though we get ridiculous amounts of work done in a short time.
How much, like, because you also do, you also sometimes do the sound design?
Yeah, I've done sound design.
Oh, for some of the movie. Was it The Hate? What's Adam's movie? Adam, Egypt, Morgan?
Oh, some kind
did
of
you
hate.
Do the sound design for that?
Parts of it, yeah. They used some of the stuff that I did.
For some reason, whatever, when I saw that movie, that was what I noticed about it, was like the editing and the sound. I think I've even told you that before. Like, that's when I watched that movie. I was like, I don't know, I'm really tuning into it. But do you guys, like, when you're on set, I always remember Coppola, like, he would always play, you know, orchestra music to sequences live, you know, for the performances to stage. Do you guys ever do anything like that, like setting the tone in
on
the staging?
On Bliss, and we won't spoil anything, but there's a, you know, as Alec was saying, a pretty story-free section in the end. And for that, we, I mean, that entire room was just Joe and Dora. So we put a little speaker on the top of the wall, hid 15 people behind this little 12 by 12 wall, and Dora and Joe just shot the scene. And I just like hooked my phone up to it, and I was playing like Gorgoroth and like Mayhem and Batillus and like all the, like the heaviest and weirdest stuff I could find for them to just have as inspiration. And they were just over there screaming at each other and like flailing around. But usually during most of our stuff, no, just because obviously dialogue is key. It's not like we're shooting like, you know, the helicopter raid in
the jungle.
Now.
Although
after that one scene, it made me want to do it more because it was pretty awesome. Well, I was burning a lot of film just kind of dancing around like, this is cool. I'm shooting in, like, a music video. I can hear it burning in my fucking ear.
We start
money.
What was the – what did you guys – I mean, I know I started with it, but I was – you guys did just Windsang at Fright Fest. What was – was that like audience award? Or
so Total Film, which is like the biggest UK
– it's a huge magazine.
Yeah, like, they gave out – they were responsible for, you know, the awards of the whole festival, and they gave us Best Picture and Best Actress.
Oh, that's great. That's
not Best Director.
Yeah. You know who else?
Very interesting.
Tarantino
the
never got one of those either.
Yeah, congratulations nonetheless.
Scorsese took a while too, apparently. Yeah. But you know, you got to have something to keep working for.
No. Yeah. Fuck picture and actress. I'm not directing.
As also film goers, did you see anything there that was particularly good?
Well, we had a lot of friends with movies there. You know, our buddy, our buddies, the Pierce brothers, who did The Wretched.
Oh, yeah. I don't know.
It's just hit film festivals this summer. It's like a creature feature.
Okay.
It was really nice to see the other crowd. We had seen some rough cuts before. We saw that the crowd supported that. Our buddy Packy had his movie there that we were
preparing
for, called Darklight.
Okay.
Fuck, what else did we see? Another Josh had another movie there that he edited, Rodman Flender's new movie.
Oh, we love Rodman.
Eat Brains Love.
And that's a zombie.
That man is a hero. Yeah, I think it's like a YA novel.
But it feels like, cause I had no, because he had been cutting it. It was one of the only movies he cut that I didn't see any cuts of. So I saw it at Fright Fest, and it legitimately feels like a late 90s studio R-rated teen horror comedy.
Oh,
it's like
Idle
Hands Light almost, but it was really fun.
Okay, good.
Yeah, and he's just the best. I think
we love Rodman here.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
He also ages backwards, which is weird.
Yeah. That's
every time I see him, like, you got younger than the last time I saw you, which is crazy. Because then you'll go, yeah, back when I was running Corman's studio when he made Frankenstein Unbound, I'm like, what? Were you four?
Him and Charlie Band hanging out in some sort of fucking preservation chamber.
It's like J.J. Abrams' little brother.
Yeah, no, he does.
Like cryo chambers they sleep in.
No, he's awesome. Anything else you've been working on?
In between, actually, Bliss and VFW, I cut the new Osgood Perkins film, Gretel and Hansel.
Oh, hell yeah. That trailer came out today, and it's pretty wonderful.
Should I watch the trailer or should I hold off?
Oh, you haven't?
I saw the other day, yeah.
No, the poster's the trailer's pretty spectacular.
Yeah, we were coloring the 16mm was so pliable that Joe and I were coloring it ourselves. We elected to save that money and just do it ourselves. So I was coloring that at night and then going to an office in Hollywood during the day to work on that film. And then the day that I was done working on that film, I threw everything out of my car and drove to Dallas to do VFW.
Oh, wow.
Nice.
How did you get – so because I know I've seen, you know, a lot of stuff. You've ever been people kind of in a pretty broad social strata, but like the heart. But I always think of Oz as deeply outside of that bubble.
There's a bunch I want to ask about, but I don't know if you're allowed to talk.
Yeah, I have a lot of questions.
But I'm curious how you got that. You know, just how do you get to people?
I think it was a combination of working on I worked on Mayhem with Joe Lynch, which was a little bit higher of a budget. I worked on Small Crimes with Evett Katz, which was a higher budget. Yeah. Then I did the Paul Solit film Bullethead, which was also a little bit higher of a budget.
Yeah.
Getting the quote up, bigger companies tend to take notice of stuff like that. And I guess I had been on a list at MGM. I had interviewed for one or two films prior that I didn't get. And then they said Osgood Perkins wants to talk to you, and who doesn't want to take that phone call?
Yeah, were you a fan of February?
Yeah.
It's still one of my favorite movies the last, like, 10 years. Like, just
Everyone I know thinks they're incredibly slow, but I just love that steeped in dread style.
Well, also, it came out of nowhere, because, like, I was at the – I guess they had a UTA – whatever the agency he came from. Friends of ours, Mark Kelly, he's an actor. They're old actors together. He's like, my friend, an actor, he made some movie. And I'm like – so we show up to the movie thinking I'm doing him a favor by showing up, and I watch this movie, and I'm like, holy shit, that's the best horror film I've seen in years. Did not see that coming, because, you know, again he took it so seriously, and I think that's the thing. He's like taking it it's not just a throwaway thing. He really invested in this, the emotion of that horror film, you know.
Absolutely. And one small anecdote I will give you is that the first phone call that we had, he said, you know, there's one thing that I want to ask you, and he's like, I don't know if you've seen my movies, but a lot of the people that have seen my movies say that they're slow, and the only thing that I want to say is that I'm not interested in making movies for those people. So that's cool.
It's a good approach.
That's cool, because I like your movies. He's like, great, okay, awesome.
And Josh shows up wearing his I Watch Andrei Tarkovsky t-shirt that I know you have. And you're like, I just sold the deal. That's why you have that. I get it now.
Oh, yeah.
So outside of – so VFW, I guess that's super in terms of when is this going to be available besides Beyond Fest? Is it going to hit festivals, or is it more – is it a release date film? What's the deal?
It's going to play festivals for the next few months, and then it will have a release date that's probably much sooner than you would expect.
Okay.
Yeah. So right now
I have no expectations. I'm just open.
It's Fantastic Fest World Premiere and then Beyond Fest, and they just announced it today. It's going to be playing at the Telluride Horror Show, which we're both big fans of, so it's exciting to go back there. I think that might be all the ones that are announced.
Yeah, there's some others, but they're not announced yet. But yeah, it'll be cruising theaters.
Cool.
Cruising festivals. In the next couple of months.
I'm curious if there's anything you could talk about that you learned from the experience of making and releasing both Almost Human and The Mind's Eye. And what I mean by that is, you know, you guys strike me as like, you know, if things aren't moving, basically you've made every movie on your own, with the exception of VFW, which obviously Dallas got involved in, but you're not waiting around. And that's the thing. It's like Almost Human came out. It got a lot of attention, especially in the festivals, got a decent release. And it's like, cool, now what's next? And then it seemed like The Mind's Eye was something that you had to will to happen as well. Like, it wasn't like somebody came along and like, hey, make this. And then same deal. Like, I don't even know. Like, how did The Mind's Eye do when it came out? Did it open any doors for you? Or because it seems like, you know, there's a lot of frustrations once you put something out, gets attention, and then everyone that comes to you is pretty much full of shit.
Yeah, it was harder to make Bliss than it was Mind's Eye. That's why it took, you know, 2 years, and it's half the budget of Mind's Eye. It was just a fucking pain in the ass. Mine did really well in the festival circuit, and it kind of just did, I would say, on par with like Almost Human when it came out. But still, you would think it was easier to make movies if you have two behind you. So that's kind of also where Bliss came from, because I was just so fucking pissed off. And I was like, you know what? I fired my agents. I didn't have any representation. I still don't. So I couldn't get anything made for 2 years, and then I fired everybody, and now I have two movies. So if that means anything. But I wanted to go back and make just something. I was like, I'm just going to start over. I'm going to do something fucking super small, because I need to be making something to be like – it was the longest I had gone without actually making anything since I was like 11, because you're always constantly making shorts. And then we made Almost Human, you know, right after a short, and then we pretty much went into Mind's Eye almost right away. So it was like – felt weird not making anything for that long. Yeah, so I kind of just willed Bliss into existence. It was going to be made for a lot less, probably half of what it actually was made for. And then, like, when it was getting ready to go, we found a little bit more money. Skipper helped us find some money from the people who financed Sequence Break, and or people found the money for Sequence Break. And interestingly enough, I technically got hired for VFW based off of Mind's Eye, because I got sent the script before Bliss. Signed on to it right before I shot Bliss. So it was really weird, like, doing something so off the cuff and like so different than I'd ever done before with Bliss, and then like making a movie that I got hired for because of my previous movies. So it was weird. It was like making this movie out of left field, then making a movie that was a step up from my first two movies. So it's like, it was really bizarre doing that, but having made those first two movies, like, on those circumstances, it allowed me to realize, okay, we can make Bliss for this much less money, make it look this much bigger. And then with VFW, it allowed me to kind of know what I was doing with the effects and the action, so that I could spend more time working with, like, this large group of actors, which is something I hadn't done before. So if I hadn't had the experience of, like, doing all this action on a super low budget, VFW would have been a fucking mess and would have came out really shitty. So that helped that. And then with making Bliss, I had gotten, like, all the stuff out of my system system with Mind's Eye and Almost Human, where it's like, all right, I got all the homages out of my system. I kind of want to go and make something that's like completely fucking different than anything that's being made right now, kind of like a fuck you to everybody. So, yeah, those. If I didn't make those first two movies, I never would have had like Bliss and VFW. But now that I made such two different movies, it's like, oh, people can go and see Bliss and watch VFW and go, oh, those came from the same guy. I can see it, but they're really different movies. Mm. They like feel and look and smell the same, but they're way, way different, like as far as execution and overall theme.
What would you – I mean, after VFW, what would you want to do if you could do anything as the next thing? What kind of thing would you want to leap to if it was if there was no limitations?
I don't know, like an NC-17 robot movie.
That's a very specific answer.
On 16mm? I don't know.
I love that you chose – I just gave you anything you wanted and you chose 16 over 35. You could have said 60mm for Christ's sake.
I just like the NC-17. That was so specific and robot.
What kind of robot?
But if you heard that there was like a killer robot movie shot on 16 that was NC-17, oh, yeah, would you not want to fucking
see it? No, I got you.
I would. Yeah. But yeah.
Okay, well, somebody make that happen. We know Dallas listens, so.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, I mean, I guess the next thing is going to be seeing this shit at Beyond Fest, right?
Yeah.
So you said, but
Bliss will be out at the end
Bliss
of this
before,
month.
Before, yeah, Beyond Fest.
September 27th.
Cool. Yeah.
So it's like we play at Fantastic Fest and Bliss comes out a couple days later. It's weird, too. VFW and VFW World Premiere and the Bliss release are in the same week. It kind of hit me a couple days ago. I was like, oh, this is fucking weird. Now that I'm unemployed again, I had time to actually think about, oh, wait, this is bizarre.
Have any of the cast members of VFW seen anything?
Stephen Lang did.
Okay, cool.
And he thankfully was very excited about what he saw.
Okay,
which
cool.
Is, Dallas was like, oh, so we sent Stephen Lang the link. I'm like, what? What the fuck? Thankfully, he liked it.
Cool. Are any of them going to be at the Beyond Fest or you don't know yet?
According to the Beyond Fest press release, William Sadler and Stephen Lang are going to be there. So I guess
that's great. Congratulations.
They worked that out.
We'll come to the Q&A because we talked to William Sadler once at
Texas
amazing. Frightmare. Is probably our favorite. No one filmed it, but if they had, it was probably the best thing
yeah, we
like
did.
That
we
never
were in
done.
Like, because, you know, at Texas like Frightmare, room. There's two rooms. There's a small one and the big theater. And they just, I don't know why, they just like paired me and Elric up with Sadler in the small room.
It was so fun.
So there's like 50 people in there, nobody filming it, no evidence. And we just had the best hour-long candid conversation with him.
Oh,
that felt like we were like he was like at a campfire telling stories.
It was probably the most fun I've had.
And it was
doing
so
that
cool.
Kind of
and I got to say, it's really bias aside, it's really fun to see them all together.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
You know, like it's as simple as like, oh, I love all these guys from different movies, and there they are. Even Martin Cove, who I remember I gave shit to Steel Justice because. I just can't see him as a good guy ever because of Karate Kid.
Yeah.
And he's a very likable character.
He's really good in the
and
movie.
And like, why? You're a nice guy. I can't believe it.
He's fucking awesome in the movie. And I mean, another thing too is I was so nervous about all these guys. There was no ego whatsoever, no personality issues. And even though I was there operating the camera and basically the set was cordoned off, so I was with these guys just in a room, like me, the sound guy, and them. Completely listened to me, had to, you know, would also help me and be like, you know, realizing I was dealing with an ensemble of eight legends. Stephen Lang especially would be like, you know, he'd help give me advice or be like, oh, did you think about this or stuff like that. So, and then if they were dicking off or giving stuff that I didn't like and I needed to be assertive, they would immediately fall into line and kind of do their thing. So, I mean, my anxieties about that went away. They were all completely fucking awesome, and I don't know if I'll ever be able to repeat the experience where there's like all these heroes in a movie who are jaded, you would think, and you know, older, pulling all-nighters, doing stunts, and you know, getting covered in blood. But also, like, I'm sitting there covered in blood, operating the camera, yelling at him with a fucking camera roll, and like, I feel like they kind of on the spot and have to listen. And then if one of them, you know, I feel like out of all of them, you know, nobody wants to be the asshole. They all want to kind of one up each other, and it was really cool.
Well, and none of them really knew each other until this movie, and then they became kind of buddies, right?
Yeah.
Because I know Dallas was telling me they'd have lunch together, and I just like I could imagine them all becoming buddies.
Yeah, they'll go out drinking and
I want to walk into that Denny's where they're all just sitting there having lunch.
I want it to be like Cheers, and George Wendt's the only one from Cheers, and then everyone else just comes in, and Stephen Lang becomes
Williamson.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that sounds rad. Well, I'm glad I'm glad this is your first press stop.
Sort of.
We're number one.
There was like a set visit that happened when I was shooting, but I don't know if that's a press stop.
I don't know. For me, this is the stuff I want Fangoria to be doing, because, you know, like the Fangoria of old, I always loved the magazine, but I always felt when it came to the movies, I was always like, it felt very straight to video. And I love this new reinvention.
They were.
And the budget's probably.
It was weird.
But I'm excited.
Mind Warp was never meant for theaters.
Don't even get me started.
That's a different episode.
Yeah, I feel like you would see the Fangoria logo 20 years ago in a movie, and I go,
yeah. I love that they're reinventing that, and I think that's exciting. So, and you guys are what, movie 3? In the rebrand?
Yeah.
It'll be movie 3. Cool.
Yeah. Little Estrike, Satanic Panic.
Yeah.
And Castle Freak next.
Oh, yeah. That's right. Barbara Crampton's been out there. Yeah. So anyway, awesome. Congrats, guys. Double feature at the Beyond Fest. Be there or be square.